ordinance in that reading.
Daniel 7, verse 1 to 8 and 23 to 27, correct? Is that right? In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast had also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up from among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. Starting at verse 23. Thus he said, The fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue 3 kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion, to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion, and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven, shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. This is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart.
Now, brethren, let's give our attention to our brother Jim as we consider the signs of the times and Russia triumphant and Europe chained. Brother Jim.
Thanks again, Brother D, and good afternoon, brethren and sisters and young people. But we come to talk now about the times in which we are living, and they are indeed momentous times. And by the time that I'm finished this session this afternoon, I hope to convince you absolutely that our days are seriously numbered. And the issues that we've spoken about over the course of this weekend, we need to be diligently weaving into our lives, because the day of judgment is unquestionably at hand. And you'll see why I say that as we proceed. It was in 1854 that Brother Thomas wrote a book called Anatolia. But when you turn to the frontispiece, it had a longer title than that. It was otherwise known by this title, Russia Triumphant and Europe Chained. That's where we've taken our title for today's talk from. Being an exposition of prophecy showing the inevitable fall of the French and Ottoman empires, the occupation of Egypt and the Holy Land by the British, the formation of a Russian Latino-Greek confederacy, its invasion and conquest of Egypt, Palestine and Jerusalem, its destruction on the mountains of Israel, the long-expected deliverance of the Jews by the Messiah, his subjugation of the world through their agency, and consequent establishment of the Kingdom of Israel. Not a bad title for a book. We now know it as the Exposition of Daniel. And I will make this statement, that if you can come to grips with this book, the exposition of Daniel, you have prophecy by the throat. It's not easy. It's actually a book written of the lectures that John Thomas gave in the 1850s, which were 2 hours long. I'll just read them. They were public lectures. And yet most Christadelphians today struggle, even with Elpis Israel, leave alone, exposition of Daniel. So there's a challenge there to the younger brethren. I see a couple of heads nodding. There's a challenge there. When you've got this book by the throat, you've got prophecy by the throat. Okay? We're going to talk about some of the things that appear in this book. Anatolia, by the way, means the east or the day spring. And that comes out of the title. The long expected deliverance of the Jews, the establishment of the kingdom on the mountains of Israel. This was the day spring that Brother Thomas looked for. I want to just begin by a short history of Russia. Russia triumphant, Europe chained is our title, remember. We can't talk about all the things that have to do with Russia and the establishment of the Gogian Confederacy. We did a bit of that last year, and there'll be some here who will remember elements of that, and I think we may have even showed you a short movie on the rise of Vladimir Putin. We're not going to cover that ground again. I want to focus a little more today on the rise of the power of the Russian Orthodox Church and to see what intentions they have and how this fits with prophecy. It was in AD 862 that Rurik, a Viking king, assumed control of the Slavic kingdoms in the east that came to be known as the Land of the Rus. By 989, Grand Prince Vladimir I of Kiev, and that was their first capital, converted to Christianity. The new religion soon spread to other Russian principalities, although Russia was very small by comparison with its size today. In 1156, Moscow was founded. In 1240, the Mongol armies sacked Kiev. They made life difficult for several hundred years. Russia became part of the Mongol Empire until 1480. In 1448, the Russian Orthodox Church became independent of Constantinople's patriarch. And that's very significant because, you see, what had happened is that the Eastern Orthodox religion, which was, of course, installed in Constantinople, was evicted in 1453 when the Turks took that city. Now, prior to that, this religion had gone to Russia. But when in 1453 the Turks overthrew Constantinople and it became a Muslim city, Moscow became the Third Rome. That is very, very significant. 1480, of course, Ivan III of Moscow freed Russia from Mongol control, and Moscow became preeminent in Russia. So what's happening there today? Well, let's take a look at what Microsoft Encarta says about the Russian Orthodox Church, its origins. Throughout most of the history of the Orthodox Church, the principal patriarch was of Constantinople, now called Istanbul, because the city was the seat of the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire, which between AD 320 and 1453 was the centre of Eastern Christendom. In 1448, the Orthodox Church in Russia declared its independence from Constantinople. And in 1589, the Patriarchate of Moscow and all Russia was established. And so Moscow became known as the Third Rome. For the Russian Church, they go on to say, and the Tsars, Moscow had become the Third Rome, the heir to the imperial supremacy of ancient Rome and Byzantium. Now what we're seeing today, after, of course, 70-odd years of the suppression of the Russian Orthodox Church, is its rise to prominence and power and influence in Russia. They have stood behind the presidents that followed the chaos of the early 1990s when the USSR fell apart. It was the church that backed the rise of Yeltsin and then Putin and then Medvedev. They have played a very prominent part. So here is Russia as it existed under communism in 1971. This little area here that you can see outlined, that was Russia in 1584. And so from 1584, they went from that size to this size in 1971. And communism suppressed the Russian Orthodox Church for about 70 years from the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. Now they are back. And the events, of course, of 1989, of which they've just celebrated the 20th anniversary, were very, very significant. And the Catholic Church under John Paul II, in cahoots with President Ronald Reagan, who of course was president in the 1980s, and the European countries, supported the undermining of the communist system, and finally the Berlin Wall came down. And we have the situation that we see today. I mention this for the young people's sake, because if you weren't born in the 1970s, then the events of 1989 probably don't mean very much to you. But this was a highly significant event, and it was to see, of course, great changes come. Now, what we know from prophecy is this, brethren and sisters and young people. We know that Europe will fall into the grasp of Russia. The dictator of that power will be, of course, the Gog of Ezekiel 38, and Gog speaks of a dictator. That system is now installed in Russia, as we saw last year. All it needs is the Gog, whoever that may be. And God, of course, knows who he is. He's alive today. There's no question about that. And he will be installed in due time. What we know from prophecy is that the European nations, the allies of Gog, they're the ones mentioned in Ezekiel 38, verse 5, will be embraced by political coercion based upon economic dependence and blackmail. And Russia's already shown its hand in this regard, aided, of course, by religious accommodation between Roman Catholicism, the dominant religion of Europe, and the Russian Orthodox Church, which, of course, has for centuries been out of kilter with the Catholics. They are now making giant strides to bring those two organizations at least into step, if not into absolute submission, of the Russian Church to the Roman Catholicism. At least they're bringing them into step. And of course, all we need, as we're going to show, is two legs of the image empire that walk together, cooperate together, as two legs should. So this is what we expect, that the European nations will not be conquered by Gog. They will simply be embraced, absorbed through political and commercial coercion and blackmail. We'll talk more about that in a moment. We also know from Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, that Constantinople will be taken by force, by conquest. It says in Daniel 11, 40, then the king of the north shall push at him, shall come against him like a whirlwind, it says. The king of the south, of course, we know, was the events of 1917. And the king of the north will come down upon Turkey. Initially, maybe by stages, initially they take Constantinople, which is effectively a European city, and Russia has always regarded it as its own. We also know from Daniel chapter 7, and a bit more about that later, that what is called the residue, these eastern areas that have been so much in the news, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan in the last 10 years or so, that's the residue referred to in Daniel chapter 7, verse 7, and that's why things are happening there. And Gog is going to take that by conquest. So we're going to try and cover a bit of that ground as we proceed. Here's just one slide that we would have shown last year, because we would have based our talk on the rise of the dictatorship in Russia under Vladimir Putin on Habakkuk chapter 2. And this is what Habakkuk 2, 5 and 6 says of this dictator. Yea, also because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell and as death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. Shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his? How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. Now this phrase at the end of verse 6 actually means the weight of pledges. It talks about putting people under your control and influence by putting them in your debt. So they actually are heavily laden with the weight of pledges. And we're going to talk about those pledges. Because, of course, what Russia is doing is precisely that right now. Russia has the greatest reserves of mineral resources of any country in the entire world. It's especially rich in mineral fuels, containing the world's largest natural gas reserves, second largest coal reserves, eighth largest oil reserves, and is among the world leaders in deposits of iron ore, asbestos, zinc, nickel, cobalt, diamonds, potassium, lead, gold, platinum, and uranium. And the list goes on. And they're using that to bring the European nations under their control, making them increasingly dependent on these natural resources. Russia currently supplies over 25% of Germany's gas requirements. In a decade, that will exceed 80%. And they will have the ability to coerce nations like Germany and many others in Western Europe to come under their umbrella, even if they were unwilling. And Germany is not unwilling. A lot of things have been happening between Germany and Russia in the last couple of years. Significant things which are bringing to pass. Ezekiel chapter 38, verses 5 and 6. Russia just happens to be today the world's top oil producer. This report from Radio Free Europe said Russia is once again the world's leading oil exporter, a spot it has occupied several times since 2002. The production hike has helped improve economic figures. And so on the 8th of September last year, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, the effective ruler of Russia, said the government might revise its budget figures for the next 3 years. I wonder what they might do with all of these surplus funds that are flooding in to Russia, while America is printing money to buy its own worthless treasury bonds. I wonder what Russia will do with the money coming into their coffers. Oil accounts for a third of Russia's exports and more than half of state revenues. Russia is also the world's biggest producer of natural gas and the largest combined energy exporter. It's massive power that it has in its hands. The state has renationalized much of its oil industry that was sold to the oligarchs in the 1990s. And there were 19 of them in 2005 who were billionaires in Russia. 16 of those were Jews. Okay. They bought up all of these assets in the 1990s. The government has taken most of them back and chased these so-called oligarchs out of the country, sometimes taking control of private companies by force. We've seen a bit of that going on. So here we have what the current position is in relation to Russia's clout in Eurasia. It's enormous. So who's behind all of this? Where's all this coming from? Well, it's actually coming from Constantinople. You say, but how? Well, because of this. This heraldry, the double-headed eagle, was the symbol of the Eastern Roman Empire. It was based in Constantinople. And the power, thus protecting the Roman Church, because in its early history, the Eastern emperors from 324 AD right down until there was a severance between the West and the East in the late 600s, right down to that time, it was the Eastern emperors that gave power to the Bishop of Rome and ultimately the Pope in the West. Double-headed eagle? Why two heads? Well, East and West. That's what it represents. East and West. And what's this thing in the middle here? This is a man riding on a white horse and spearing a black dragon. They take that imagery from Revelation chapter 12. And that imagery to the Russians represents this. Russia is depicted as the man-child Michael, he's the one on the horse, slaying the dragon. So who does Russia regard as the dragon today? We know, of course, that they've totally misinterpreted Revelation chapter 12, but who do they think is the dragon? Well, this may suggest the answer. The triumph of the cross over the crescent. Now, this is the cross of the Russian Orthodox Church. And do you see what it is standing on? You see down here, this is a moon-shaped crescent. That is the symbol for the Muslims. Crescent moon. That's why they have the red crescent and not the red cross in Muslim countries. This is the symbol for the Muslims. And so we see here that the cross is standing on top of the crescent moon. This is about dominating the Muslims, of which, of course, Russia has many in its southern underbelly. Russian Orthodoxy seeks the removal of Muslim control of Constantinople. And more than that, we're going to see in a moment that they've actually begun a campaign to overthrow the power of the Mohammedan religion in the south. Meanwhile, back in 2007, they began a program in the Russian military forces to change all of the heraldry on people's uniforms, on their hats and helmets, etc. And that's a massive task. They began a program of replacing the Soviet-era flags, you know, the hammer and sickle symbols, of the 2,135 military units, and introducing the new ensigns, the Tsarist symbols of crowns and eagles, the double-headed eagle, so that when Gog comes down upon the land, all of their soldiers, their navy, and air force personnel will be wearing the heraldry of the double-headed eagle. Now that's very significant because that came from Constantinople. We're going to talk a bit about that and why that's important to you and me. But this is what the Russian Orthodox Church is doing. This is a report from the 24th of February 2009. Under the heading, Russian Orthodox Church sets out to be first among equals, it says this, and asks the question, is the Russian Orthodox Church set to launch a new crusade at home and abroad? Well, one of their representatives, this gentleman here, said, a prominent Russian missionary said, recently urged the opening of an Orthodox base in Kyrgyzstan from which to launch a proselytizing offensive across mostly Muslim Central Asia. The church should open theological faculties in Bishkek universities and use Kyrgyzstan as a base for all of Central Asia, Afghanistan, Tibet and China. Now that would be a massive campaign, but they've begun it to try and convert as many as they can of the Muslims in the underbelly of Russia, in all of those Stan states, you know, the ones that end with S-T-A-N, all of them, most of them, are Muslim. He goes on to say this, Kirill, who of course took over from Alexei II when he died last year, this is the new head of the Russian Orthodox Church, he has made some very clear statements. On February the 1st, he intends to intensify his church's politically fraught mission at home and in Russia's near abroad with the apparent full blessing of the Kremlin. It's real. The Moscow Patriarchate is devoted to the idea of a great Russia. Viktor Yelensky, president of the Ukrainian Association of Religious Freedom, told delegates on February the 16th. What will that lead to? Evidently, Kirill wants it to be a Putin church. He, as the Metropolitan of Smolensk, once said the Russian church should hold first place among all other Orthodox churches, the one installed today in Constantinople, he means, including that one, which is traditionally considered first among equals in the galaxy of Orthodox patriarchates. And then he said this, I want you to take careful note of this. We are the rightful heirs of Byzantium, that is Constantinople, and the kingdom that surrounded it. We are the rightful heirs of Byzantium, the Eastern Roman Empire, he means. It has to be re-established, brethren and sisters and young people, and it's on the way. And Russia has always had the ambition to control Constantinople. Again, Microsoft Encarta says, Russia fought no more wars with Turkey until 1914, and before that they had fought dozens of them with Turkey. Presumably sensing that it was too weak to gain control of the straits in the face of European opposition. In World War I, it won the approval of Britain and France for the ultimate annexation of Constantinople and the straits after the war. but things changed. But military defeat and revolution in 1917 rendered these hopes vain. But that didn't stop Stalin. For after World War II, Russia sought to annex Constantinople in the terms of the promise that the Western nations had made prior to the First World War. And it was only British, French and American intervention and the ultimatum that they delivered to Stalin that halted that attempt. Russia has always desired to lay its hands on Constantinople. That's where its religion came from. It wants control of that city, and it has to have it because it has to be the eastern leg of the image of Nebuchadnezzar. And that, brethren and sisters, will be the end result of the process of the drying up of the great river Euphrates, the sixth vial event, the first of them, that began in 1820. And now, of course, Turkey looks like that. Its massive empire of 350-odd years ago is now this sick man of Europe, this power that cannot join the EU because they're Muslim. The current president of the EU says he will never allow them to join. And they're stuck here, right beneath Russia's advance from the north into the Middle East. They're going to play a part. And the troubles that we see there and the troubles further east are all part of the fulfillment of Bible prophecy. You know, back in 79, the Time magazine had this front cover. Here is the Russian bear, communist then, looking down upon what they called the crescent of crisis. It was a crescent of crisis in the 1970s. It's been a crescent of crisis in the last 10 years or so since the events of 9/11. I want to talk a little bit about that. Now, you're all familiar, of course, with the imagery of Daniel chapter 2. We know that the image of Nebuchadnezzar, and that's what we should call it, not Daniel's image. He would be very upset by that. This is Nebuchadnezzar's image. Okay? We know it represents the succession of world empires through Babylon and Medo-Persia, the Grecian, then the Roman, down, of course, to the time in which we live, the time of the feet of the image, which are in the process of now being formed. Those feet are part of iron and part of clay. The iron represents that which remains of the Roman Empire, its religion. The clay is the democracy and the republicanism of the modern states of Europe. They will be brought together in a brittle relationship for the purpose of Armageddon. This entire image, however, has to stand complete. Now, that's the clear message that was given to Nebuchadnezzar by the interpretation of the dream by Daniel. He said in verse 28, "But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days." So this was not about just a succession of empires. This is about what would happen in the latter days. This image would have to stand complete. A power would have to arise that would put together the peoples who belong to the territories of the head, the chest, the belly and thighs, the legs. He would have to bring them all together into one massive image power. And that power would only stand when it took the land of Israel, the last place it needed to bring all of the territories of the four empires together. That's why they're destroyed together. Verse 35, "Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver and the gold broken to pieces together." They can only be broken to pieces together if they've all stood up together in the image of the latter days. That's a very important element of understanding Daniel chapter 2. This is the Gogian Confederacy, the embracing of Europe, the taking of Turkey, the embracing of the residue, and then the final requirement, taking Egypt and then Israel. And then the image can be complete. Then it can stand up upon its feet. That, brethren and sisters, we see in the process of happening right now. And Brother Thomas comments upon this in Anatolia, exposition of Daniel. He says this scene, it's about Nebuchadnezzar's image yet to stand, this scene has never been exhibited before the eyes of the world because the constituents of the Colossus have never yet been put together so as to form the image of the scene. These constituents are represented by the different metallic parts and the clay feet and toes. So here we have Nebuchadnezzar's image. It is yet to stand up. It will only stand up when Gog is in the land of Israel. But it has to have all of these elements drawn together. The peoples, the nations who inhabit the territories of the four world empires have to be brought together by Gog. And they will be under the Babylonian head, the thinking power behind all of this. The western leg, of course, is the latter-day redevelopment of the Western Roman Empire centered in Rome. The eastern leg is the latter-day redevelopment of the Eastern Roman Empire centered in Constantinople. So this is what prophecy requires, and intelligent readers of the signs of the times know that giant strides are being made in the accomplishment of what is required by that prophecy. The legs, of course, are there in the fact that you have Rome and Constantinople. The only problem is that Gog needs to be in Constantinople. That's why the interest of the Russian Orthodox Church is so important. We are the rightful heirs of Byzantium, Kirill says. He has enormous influence in Russia upon Putin and Medvedev. So Gog, as a little horn of the goat of Daniel chapter 8, and the king of the north of Daniel chapter 11, has to be in Constantinople in the eastern leg. While over here in the west, the papacy in Rome, Babylon the Great, forming its power in the west through the European Union. You know, when the empire of Rome was finally divided into two parts, in the year AD 420, Rome had left Britain. So when the two legs were formed, Britain was no longer part of the Roman Empire. And events are leading to the forcing of Britain out of the European Union to play the role of Tarshish of Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 13. But what we have here, brethren and sisters, is the clear indications that the time is about to dawn when the image power will stand upon its feet. The latter-day counterpart is in the process of development, and Gog is going to finish that process. The feet, with 10 toes on them, is a confederation of European states united for a time by Gog, a brittle fusion of democracy and false religion. But there are 27 nations in the European Union today. 27 of them. How can you get 10 out of 27? Well, for one, Britain's got to come out. And then, when we are taken to judgment and the time of trouble such as never was begins in fulfillment of Daniel 12 verses 1 and 2, and that time of trouble will start, brethren and sisters and young people, when we are removed, read it carefully, when the great collapse comes, and we'll talk about that in the financial system that's about to go over the precipice very soon, when that comes, the 26 nations that are there today are going to be resolved over time into the 10 required by the prophecy of Daniel chapter 2, of Daniel 7, and of Revelation chapter 17 and verse 12, with the 10 horns. And that process is already underway in the pigs group. You've heard about these, haven't you? The pigs in Europe? The EU requires that all its participating nations, 27 of them today, maintain their deficits at less than 3% of GDP, gross domestic product. Who amongst the nations of the 27 have fallen short of this? Well, there's Portugal with 7.6, Italy with 5.4, Greece massively over budget, 12.7, and Spain 9.6. You know what that means? The pigs are nearly bankrupt. But the European Union has a problem. A very serious problem. These people want to be bailed out of bankruptcy. But there's another 23 or so of these nations in the EU who will also want to put their hand out. So the EU is very reluctant to rescue the pigs because many other nations of the 27 will call for similar help. So when the crash comes, and God is preparing the ground for this, when the crash comes, many of these powers, and I'm not going to suggest which ones because I don't know, but many of these powers who owe their origin to barbarian invasion of the Roman Empire in the 300s and 400s AD are going to have to simply either be absorbed into other nations or reduced in some way simply to survive economically and to maintain any kind of independence. And they have to be, the 10 have to be independent. It says in Revelation 17, verses 12 onwards, that these 10 kings will give their power unto the beast for 1 hour. That's 30 years. The last 30 years of divine judgment on the earth, as we shall see in a moment. So they maintain their independence, but they have to be refined down to the 10 required by Bible prophecy. We're already beginning to see how that is going to occur. Let's go back to these feet. What do you do with feet? Well, you can walk or you can stamp. And these feet of the image are stamping feet. It is while the post-Ottoman dynasty, he means Gog, occupies the throne that the stamping the residue with the feet of the beast is accomplished. So he's talking about the time when Gog comes and seizes Constantinople, and we have our eastern leg, the revival of the Byzantium or Eastern Roman Empire. Gog, there in Constantinople, because the Russian Orthodox Church wants to go home to where it came from. While they are there, he says, the stamping or conquering of the residue by its feet will be accomplished. The claws of these feet are of brass, while the feet themselves are part of iron and part of clay. For the feet of Nebuchadnezzar's image and those of the fourth beast are representative of the same power. I want to talk a little bit about what he means by the stamping of the residue. So let's have a look at that verse which was read for us from Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7. The seventh verse here speaks of the fourth empire. And there will only be five world empires upon the earth. The first was begun by Nimrod. It was the Babylonian, the Assyro-Babylonian Empire. It came to an end in 539 BC. It was followed by the Medo-Persian Empire, which ruled for 206 years, the first two of those by a Mede, and then by the Persian kings who succeeded him. That was followed by the Empire of Alexander the Great, almost the same proportions in size, which came effectively, of course, to an end when the Romans came to power in 67 BC. And that fourth beast is the one that Christ will destroy. We read that in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 11 and 12. It says this, I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast, he means the fourth beast, the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As concerning the rest of the beasts of course representing Babylon, Medo-Persia and Greece, their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Now that means that it's the fourth beast or Roman beast that Christ and the saints will destroy in the events of Armageddon and the 40 years of conflict that will follow. And the fifth empire upon the earth will be the kingdom of God. Interesting, isn't it? Five, the number of grace. That is the story of Daniel chapter 7. So this fourth beast has to be revived in all its power and its splendor. And it has something to do in its latter day history that it did not do in previous history. It did not do this. It says it devoured and brake in pieces. Well, it did a bit of that, but it didn't do this. And stamped the residue with the feet of it. What does that mean? What is the residue? Well, let's just do a quick survey of the territories of these four world empires. It becomes very obvious what the residue is. Here's the Assyro-Babylonian Empire, began by Nimrod, of course terminated in the times of Belshazzar, 539 BC. Nimrod's kingdom. You see this brownish area? That was Babylon of old. It was succeeded by the Medo-Persians, massively increased in size, going right over here into Macedonia and Greece, embracing Egypt, right over to the Indus River over here in the east, including Afghanistan and Pakistan of today. It was followed by the Grecian Empire, 334 to 67 BC, similar sort of area to that occupied by the Persian Empire, massive in its proportions. And here's the Roman. Now, the Roman was largely in the west. Most of it was over here, North Africa, Europe, etc. Never took control of the area beyond what we would call Iraq today. And in fact, brethren and sisters and young people, the Romans were forced backwards. They got up to the Persian Gulf. They had control of this area here at one time, but the Parthians drove them back. And Trajan's conquests in the east were abandoned by his successor Hadrian in AD 118. And he pushed back to a line along here, north and south. And today you can go to Jordan and you can visit the sites, every Roman mile of the watch houses, the garrisons that were built in that north-south line. That, brethren and sisters, is as far as Rome controlled. It did not possess the massive areas controlled by the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks in the east. So when you look at a map, here is the residue that's being referred to in Daniel 7, verse 7. It includes modern Iran. It includes the Stan states here in the south of Russia. It includes Afghanistan and half of Pakistan. And I believe also, of course, it's going to include an area to the west. So here they are. It includes this area of Iraq because the Romans got down to here, but they were pushed back to a line down here. So this is the residue that the fourth beast has to stamp with the feet of it. In other words, it's telling us that Gog has some work to do. And you know, anybody that's really looking at what's happening there in Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan can see the beginnings of this. Because a vacuum's going to be created. When America and the European allies and Australia and Canada are forced to withdraw their forces from Afghanistan and the Americans are forced out of Iraq, and probably the great collapse will accomplish that, when that happens, there will be a vacuum here. Those in Iraq who believe that they should rule, the Shiites, the majority, will be in trouble. There will be civil war there. We know that. And their next door neighbours, the Iranians, who are, of course, almost 100% Shiite, will come in and say, "We'll help you, brothers." And Iraq will disappear. We'll have the greater Persia of Ezekiel 38 and verse 6. And Russia will also come back, as it did in the 1970s. It will come back into Afghanistan. It showed its hand 30 years ago, but it, of course, was chased out with its tail between its legs because it made a fundamental military mistake that the British made in the 1880s, that other people have made, that America and its allies are making today. You cannot subdue Afghanistan unless you take the mountain ranges to the west of that country and to the east of that country. This is where Osama bin Laden is. He's up in here somewhere. He's protected by the people who rule this area. They're autonomous. Nobody controls them. And so if you want to take Afghanistan, you have to do this. You have to take Iran next door and you have to take Pakistan to the east. And then you can starve them out. So the Russian generals won't make the same mistake again. And it will be Gog, who in possession of Constantinople, will stamp the residue with the feet of it. That's not a comfortable process for the people who happen to be underneath the feet. That's about conquest. Whereas they will embrace the European powers by coercion and blackmail, loading them with a weight of pledges, they're going to conquer these areas. And they have to be part of the Gogean Confederacy. That's what Ezekiel 38 verse 6 is about. And that we can see. We can see the beginnings of that happening. Pakistan will be absorbed. And I don't think there's any doubt that when the Russians come down to the Indus River, the Indians will come from the other direction and take up the rest of Pakistan. And you'll have, of course, your Eastern Tarshish. Eastern Tarshish, yes. India has been a friend of the Russians for a long time, since the days of Indira Gandhi, but that's coming undone. India just happens to have the largest navy of any nation in the Indian Ocean. It's a naval power. The Eastern Tarshish, once pro-Russian, now swinging hard towards the West, and, above all things, most importantly, a very, very close friend of Israel. Isn't that interesting? And that's happened in the last few years. Very close friend of Israel. Because they both have interests, of course, in the electronic world of which Israel and India are the leaders today. So you can see how the hand of God is working here. And Brother Thomas says this in Anatolia. He says, under the heading Gog Victorious, the image standing. He says, during the reign of the Clay Dynasty, the image stands upon its feet for the first time, having incorporated in it not only Nimrudia, the area of Iraq, and Persia, but the nation of the Greeks, or brazen goats, and the Holy Roman Empire in the west, and its papal kingdoms of iron legs and toes. Not a bad summary, is it, of what we've just been talking about? And the drama of Daniel 2, and it is a drama, brethren and sisters and young people, is incredible. Because this image cannot stand up until it's got all the peoples who live in the territories of the four world empires. And that includes Israel. Israel was part of Babylon, it was part of Medo-Persia, it was part of Greece, it was part of Rome. So until they're victorious in the land, the image is not complete. Can't stand up. And that's the drama of it. When they are victorious in the land and they set the tabernacle of their power between the seas in my glorious holy mountain, says God, and there's only a few Jews holding out in the old city of Jerusalem, Christ and the saints arrive in the Mount of Olives, it splits! And the great earthquake decimates the Gogean Confederacy. So get a picture in your mind of what's going on here. This image stands up victorious in the land. It's huge! It stands for about 5 minutes. Crash! Stone power, Christ and the saints on the feet. Bang! And then for 40 years, grinds it to powder. Got a picture? Is that dramatic? When you read Daniel 2, never read it the same again. Read it like that. And look at yourself in the stone power, because that's where we're going to be. That's the drama of it. It can only stand up. It controls the land. It's immediately toppled by Christ. And it's broken and consumed over the next 40 years. Now come to Daniel chapter 2. Verse 45. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, let it break in pieces. I want you to notice the order. Have you ever thought about this? Have you ever thought about why these metals are in this order? Ponder that for a while. He'll break in pieces the iron, the brass, and the clay. Why put those three together? The silver and the gold. Why is the gold last? You've thought about that? Well, this is the imagery. This is about the phases of the crushing of Nebuchadnezzar's image. And Armageddon is going to see the destruction of Gog in the land. This image has got two legs. They're both of iron. But one is strongly Greek. Brass. It's the eastern leg. So you've got iron and brass and clay, the democracies that form part of this massive empire. That's why those three powers, those three elements, are mentioned first. This is the events of Armageddon. As Gog comes from its base in Constantinople, in cahoots with the West in Rome, and comes down upon the land, and Christ and the saints smash the image, grind those powers. What comes next? Well, the neighbouring dominions, close by, those represented by the Persian Empire. The silver comes next. And who's the last power that Christ and the saints have to destroy before the kingdom of God can be fully established? Well, it's Babylon the Great, isn't it? It's the papacy in cahoots with the nations of Europe. That's why the gold head comes last. See that? There's a precision about that, which conforms exactly with the framework of prophecy that we would expect. And the culmination, when over 40 years this image is progressively ground to powder, will be that that stone will grow and grow and grow until the kingdom of God, the fifth empire, fills the whole earth. That's the message of Daniel chapter 2. And we're watching it happen from here. And we have to be involved in these things. We're very, very close, brethren and sisters, to this becoming a reality. Why? Why do we say that? Well, we say it for this reason. And this is why we read Daniel chapter 7, really. Let's come back to Daniel chapter 7. And we read in verse 8 that this beast which has 10 horns, that's the 10 barbarian nations formed upon the body of the Roman Empire. 10 horns. Verse 8. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. Daniel chapter 7, verse 8, as we're going to see when we come to look at the interpretation in verses 23 to 27, is about the rise of the Holy Roman Empire. That's the little horn that replaces the three there in verse 8. The rise of the Holy Roman Empire. Now that's got to end. It has to end by the year 2060. I mean, even Isaac Newton understood this. They found it in his hidden papers. He understood this. He wasn't a Christadelphian, but he did know a bit about truth. He knew that the papal system would terminate in 2060 because he rightly interpreted Daniel chapter 7. And we know from Revelation chapter 19 verse 20 that the last powers that Christ destroys before the kingdom can be fully established are the Pope and the beast who supports him. Let me just read that passage to you. It says this, and the beast, it means the revived beast of the earth, the Holy Roman Empire, was taken, and with him the false prophet, the Pope, that wrought signs before him with which he deceived them which had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image, the papacy. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. And the next chapter says the kingdom of God's established and the old serpent is bound for 1,000 years. So the last powers that Christ has to deal with is the Holy Roman Empire, which is supporting the papacy. That means this, brethren and sisters and young people. It means that when we arrive at the Mount of Olives with our Lord Jesus Christ and the Gogian forces in the land are overthrown, that the papacy in Rome will receive a heavy blow. But in the 10 years that follow Armageddon, they will rebuild their power, as Psalm 2 says that they will. Yet, says God, I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Why do the nations rage? Why do they tumultuously assemble? Because the Pope is telling the nation, this man in Jerusalem, he's the Antichrist we've been telling you about in all those DVDs and books that are floating around. He's the Antichrist. And many will believe him. And they will oppose Christ. And so 10 years after Armageddon, Revelation 14 verse 8 says that Rome goes down, the gurgler, They take another heavy blow. You think that's going to stop them? No. The Pope that was in the Vatican, he's gone down the gurgler. But they will go to Central Europe. They'll appoint a new Pope. And one of these last popes is going to be a black man, because the first Pope, Nimrod, was a black man. There'll be a new Pope. Maybe a succession of them for the next 30 years. But finally, when Elijah brings Israel into the wilderness of the peoples, read Europe, deals with the resistance to Christ's rule, brings judgment to bear upon that system, Babylon the Great, exposes it for what it is, the harlot, he will then call the nations to Jerusalem that he might reveal his true bride, whose glory has been hidden for 40 years since the events of Armageddon. That's what Revelation 19 is about. It'll take 40 years to deal with human resistance to divine rule. And it has to end. Human resistance has to end in 2060. So why do we say that? Well, let's have a bit of a closer look at what Daniel 7 verse 8 is telling us. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn. Here he is, before whom there were three of the first horns, three of the ten, plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were the eyes like the eyes of a man. They call it the Holy Sea, S-E-E. And a mouth speaking great things. The Pope issues encyclicals. And when he speaks ex cathedra since 1870, he says, I'm infallible. That's kind of mouth he's talking about. We go on. How did this happen in history? Well, the papacy fell out with Constantinople, the Eastern emperors who had supported it for so long, over idolatry of all things in the 7th century. They fell out over idolatry. So the Eastern emperor said, well, you're rowing your own canoe now, Mr. Pope. I'm sorry. So he had to row his own canoe. And three barbarian powers in northern Italy, mainly Lombards, made life very difficult for him. Very uncomfortable. So the Pope, troubled by these three barbarian powers, called upon Pepin, King of France, to come and help him. And from 754 AD onwards, Pepin came down and dealt with those three powers, and in 758 he gave those three nations of Italy, barbarian powers, to the papacy. He said, here, these are your territories now, you could rule them. So the Pope immediately proceeded to create for himself a triple tiara crown. It's got three parts to it. Three horns plucked up by the roots, given to the Pope, the beginnings of the growth of another little horn. This is the beginnings, the origins of the Holy Roman Empire. But we know from Revelation 13 that the beast of the earth, the Holy Roman Empire, had to have two horns of its own. This lamb-like creature with a lion-like mouth had to have a papal horn and an emperor horn. One religious, one political. Okay? That didn't happen until 800 AD. And it was on Christmas Day, 800 AD, that Pope Leo III in the Vatican crowned Charlemagne, the son of Pepin, King of France, as Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And he became the protector of the church to replace the Eastern emperors who had forsaken the Pope. Got the picture? The beginning of the Holy Roman Empire was 800 AD. Where do we go from there? Well, we go to verses 23 to 27 of Daniel 7. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom, Rome, upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, devour the whole earth, etc. Verse 24, and the ten kings out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. That's the history we've just talked about. And he shall speak this horn, the Holy Roman Empire, he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints. That is, any opposition. This term saints here is not about the Christadelphians. Might have included them. Not about the Christadelphians. This is about any opposition to Rome in its history. Political or religious. Doesn't matter where it came from. They were the saints of the Most High God. And God sent them against Rome. He raised them up against Rome to provide a breathing space for the true ecclesia. Okay? There's a different class of people in verse 27 that we'll come to in a moment. He shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. But at the end of that period, the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. Who takes possession of the kingdom then? Verse 27. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Now, some think this is a reference to Israel. Forget it. You know why you can forget it? Because of the title that's used. What title is that there? Used several times here. Well, it's the title Elyon, the Most High. Where does that come from, brethren and sisters? Genesis chapter 14. What's Genesis chapter 14 about? Well, it's about Armageddon. It's about a northern confederacy led by a man called Chedorlaomer, whose name means a handful of sheaves, coming down upon the land promised to Abraham, defeating a southern confederacy that has totally corrupt the Sodom and Gomorrah of its time, and taking away Abraham's natural brethren into captivity. Abraham puts together an army of home-born Jews and of Gentiles he's converted, chases after them to a place called Dan, and destroys them in the valley. Chedorlaomer, handful of sheaves, destroyed in a valley of judgment, Dan. That's Armageddon. How do I know that that's right? First time in your Bible, Genesis 14:13, it says, Abram the Hebrew. And the last time in your Bible you read the word Hebrew is in Revelation 16, verse 16. He brought them into a place called in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. Genesis 14, it's the first time that speaks of Armageddon. And what does Abraham do when he's been victorious over the northern confederacy? He comes to Salem, the name given to Jerusalem in the future age. The Yeru part, the vision part's gone. Psalm 76, verse 2 calls Jerusalem Salem. Peace. And there he finds who? Melchizedek, king of righteousness, then king of Salem. Peace. And he brings out bread and wine, the tokens of Christ's sacrifice, and feeds them to Jew and Gentile in Abram's company. That's a type, isn't it? What's he called? Melchizedek, priest of Elyon. Four times the title Elyon occurs, and every single time of its 48 occurrences, when it speaks of God, the Most High, every single time the subject matter is straight from Genesis 14. Righteousness, Melchizedek, and especially Armageddon. So these people here are not natural Jews. They are the people of the saints of the Most High. They're Christadelphians immortalized, and they take possession of the kingdom in 2060. That's interesting. They're reviving the Holy Roman Empire today in Europe. That's where these 12 stars came from, you know, from the stained glass window in Charlemagne's church. That's where they came from. And Charlemagne was on the back of the French euro coin, and the date is stamped on it, 800 AD till 814 when he died. Well, as we said, the Holy Roman Empire has to be revived. But there's an earlier stage. The first stage is when the Eastern emperors will give the papacy in the West political clout. Gog taking control of Constantinople, supporting the papacy. But Gog's destroyed at Armageddon. What does this system do then? Well, history will repeat itself. They will rebuild the beast of the earth. They've already laid the foundations for that, haven't they? And that empire, the Holy Roman Empire, in its latter-day form, and the papacy it supports, have to be destroyed by 2060. How can we say that? Well, here's the interpretation. We've looked at that passage. It tells us in verse 25, until a time, times, and a dividing of time. Now, a Jewish time is a Jewish year. That has 360 days in it. A time, 360. Times two of them, 720. half of time, or a dividing of it, 180. You put 360 plus 720 plus 180, you get 1260. On a day for a year principle, this represents 1260 years. Does this work? Yes, it does. AD 312 was the rise of Constantine when he defeated Maxentius in the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. With the support of the apostate Christian church that became the Roman Catholic Church and later on had a pope, that began witnessing against that system. Many opposed it from within and without. Add 1260, 1572 was the end of effective witnessing when on the great day of the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day, witnessing effectively came to an end in Europe. Go to the time when Justinian, the Eastern Emperor, sat in his palace in Constantinople and wrote out his Justinian Decretals between 529 and 533, giving the Bishop of Rome leadership of the church and political power in measure in the West. Add 1260 to that. You come to 1789, which was the beginning of the French Revolution, and the height of the French Revolution, 1793, when the papacy was out of business in France, its eldest son. The priests had been sacked. Church property had been confiscated. They were finished in France for the time being. Exactly 1260 years after Justinian gave his decrees. Try this one. AD 608 to 610, the decrees of Phocas granting the papacy temporal or political power in the West. So the Pope was given control over people and over territory. We call it temporal power. Add 1260, 1868 and 1870. In 1868, Garibaldi drove the Pope out of the Vatican, and by 1870, he'd lost all of his temporal power and responded by calling the First Vatican Council and declared himself infallible when speaking ex cathedra. What was his response? It works every time. So don't come and say, well, we're dealing with the Gregorian calendar, put together by Pope Gregory the 13th. That's faulty. We know it's faulty. We still use it, by the way. Don't tell me that, because these dates work every time based on the Gregorian calendar. So if you add 1260 to 800, you get 2060. And certain things have to happen, because the first event in the development of the Holy Roman Empire was Pepin, King of France, conquering those three barbarian states in 758 AD. Add 1260 to that, brethren and sisters. Where are the mathematicians in our midst? What do you come up with? 2018, which means, because the reverse always happens, it means that by 2018, Russia will have control of Constantinople and will be supporting the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, just like the Eastern Emperors did in the times of Justinian and Phocas, and he'll be back in business. And there'll be two legs walking in step. 800 AD, Pope Leo crowned Charlemagne Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Add 1260. You get 2060. Why is that significant to you and me? Well, anybody who knows anything about Ezekiel and has read Brother Sully's book on the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy knows that there will be a 50-year period from the resurrection of the dead, from the 18th year of Josiah, when men's destinies were determined in that day, to the time that Christ walks his bride, represented by Ezekiel the prophet, in Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 1 and 2, when he walks his bride around the temple to display to the world his true bride, when he's exposed the Catholic harlot for what she is. That's what Revelation 19 is about. There's 50 years. Now we don't know whether or not the year in which the papacy meets its demise is exactly the same year that Christ walks his bride around the temple. We're not told that detail, but I think it will be. Time will tell. What that means, though, is this. We've got to come back 50 years from 2060. And there may be a little bit of room for movement. When I take 50 off 2060, I arrive at 2010. And there could be some movement there. So don't let me hear anybody say that I said that Christ will definitely come in 2010. I'll be writing to you if I hear that. But you can tell as many people as you like that the Pope will be out of business in 2060. And if we're right about the 50 years, and I know we're right about that, then we have not got very long. Oh, we don't know the day or the hour, people say. I'm not talking about the day or the hour. I'm talking about the times and the seasons. And Paul said, you should know them. I'm nearly finished. How are you going there, Craig? Okay. Just a few comments. Just to back up what I said last year. Remember about the financial situation? Since then, of course, the Great Recession, as they call it, has been wreaking havoc, especially in this country. And there will be people in this room who are suffering a bit from that. Maybe. I don't know. Certainly, as I've travelled around, I've met brethren who don't have any work here and in Canada. Haven't got a job. I know some Christadelphians in California who've had to walk away from their homes and the banks just seized their property. They're living in a garage. Okay, so it has affected people. But there's worse to come. The good part about it is that you and I won't have to endure it. This is the timeline of depressions. This is how it works. In 1929, there was a recession. The leaders of the world got together, made foolish decisions, and by 1930, there was a depression. Okay, recession followed by depression. And it was very deep. And it lasted for over 10 years. And the only way the world got itself out of that depression was by war, the Second World War, breeding the times of prosperity in which we live. 2010, we're getting towards the end of the Great Recession. There are little things happening and they're talking about, oh, it's going to get better, if you can believe Obama. It's going to get better. It probably will. It'll look that way. But the leaders of the world have made decisions, and especially the American government, which guarantee a depression. Guarantees it. You cannot do what the American government is doing and get away with it. You cannot print money to buy your own treasury bonds to finance your massive deficits, which reached over $2 trillion. That's $1,000 billion. And a billion is 1,000 million. Got that? You can't do that. It lasts for about 12 to 18 months. And then you become Zimbabwe with inflation rates of 35,000% per annum and your money's worth nothing. It can't last you much longer and it won't. And the oil crisis will hit by 2012. You wouldn't think that by the American prices, would you? Come to Australia. You pay $2.69 a gallon. You know what we pay in Australia? We pay $1.20 a litre multiplied by 5. So you think you're bad. You know, you've got a problem. Come to Australia. If you don't like that, go to England. See what price they pay. Okay? The oil crisis will hit, they say, before 2012. When it hits, it will be, of course, another catalyst. You and I had to be taken in times of prosperity. The world will take at least 10 years to pull out of depression like it did prior to the Second World War, and it will only happen by war. What war do you think that might be? It's pretty obvious, isn't it? And you and I have to go to the judgment seat of Christ in times of prosperity. This is the proof of it. They were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying wives, being given in marriage. They were eating, they were drinking, they were buying, they were selling, they were planting, they were building. Can't do that in depressions. Can you do that when your pockets are full of money? As it was in the days of Noah and the days of Lot, so shall it be in the day of the Son of Man. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone. In other words, all the prosperity disappeared. And the day that you and I are taken to the judgment seat, brethren and sisters, that's the day the Great Depression will hit. And they won't be concerned about you not turning up for work, because most people will be lining up at the banks to get their money out. It will be a terrible time, a time of trouble such as never was. Because God can release controls. Saints are gone. Light's gone. Gross darkness covers the earth. Isaiah 60. He doesn't need to step in to control things as he's doing now for your sake and mine. Terrible time. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Remember Lot's wife, he said. The old struggle between the housetop where prayer and meditation was to be made, and the stuff, the implements, the apparatus in the house. Housetop was designed for prayer and meditation. This stuff fills the houses and takes too many hours of our time when we don't pray and we don't meditate because of the gadgets that fill our lives. Lot's wife tried to secure the present. She wanted to keep what she had, and she lost the future. There's an urgent warning in all that. Rotherham says of Matthew 24, verses 42 to 44, "Be watching, therefore, for ye know not on what manner of day your Lord is coming. And there is one thing ye know, that if the householder had known in what watch the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and not have suffered his house to be dug through. Wherefore, ye also be getting ready, because in what hour ye are not thinking, the Son of Man cometh." And he's coming for this reason, to bring the day spring. "Be watchful and strengthen the things which remain, because this is true. Proverbs 4:18, the path of the just is as a shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day. And while this world is descending into gross darkness, your life and mine, brethren and sisters, has to be increasing in brightness. And we can best do that by implementing the King's manifesto for life.